3 miles below the surface, as world-famous scientists, leaders of state, generals of the armies prepare to challenge the infinite.
We have within our grasp the limitless, clean heat of the inner Earth. We can transform all the continents and make a life of plenty for all mankind for the foreseeable future.
They knew that only a missile with an atomic warhead could crack the Earth's impenetrable inner core. Would it mean the end of the world or the beginning of a new life for all mankind? Surface, a man, his wife, and the man she once loved, living life as if this could be their last. Crack in the world, as Project Inner Space upsets the delicate balance of the Earth's core, rips our planet in two, bringing disaster in its wake, destruction, irrational terror, and unbelievable courage.
What if the crack keeps going, right around the world? What happens then?
Where the landmass is split, the oceans will be sucked in, and the colossal pressure generated by the steam will rip the Earth apart and destroy it.
It isn't possible. It's insane. Is there anything that we can do?
Pray.
Daring scientists descend into a 1,000-degree inferno with a live H-bomb in their deadly gamble to save the universe.
Holy bejeebus, folks. Holy fucking bejeebus. Holy fucking crapola. Ayatollah of rock and rolla. It is November, the 24th, right? Sunday, November the 24th. 2019. November the 24th, 2019, folks. November the 24th, I'll tell you what, folks. Of all the old-timey sci-fi film classics from the 1960s, of all the ridiculous sci-fi films I saw in my youth as reruns or on sci-fi theater, A Crack in the World is probably one of the most ridiculous. I will tell you this. If you give a geologist a nuclear weapon, if you provide for a geologist, I don't care how many PhDs, if they are a fucking geologist, and you give that fucking geologist a nuclear weapon, then I think you have a crack in your head. I think you have a crack in your head. You know, don't worry about the crack in the world. You've got a crack in your head, buddy. Somebody needs to fix that shit. But here's the thing. if you give one geologist one nuclear weapon, and that geologist with that hydrogen bomb ends up, you know, creating a crack in the world that threatens to split the world in half, do you then say to yourself, as the world leaders are probably... And folks, one of the interesting things, I'm going to do a little side note here. One of the interesting things, and maybe the undercurrent, maybe the psychological undercurrent of a crack in the world, because it is a British film. It is a British film. It is so very fucking British. And it came out in 1965. And if you know anything about the collapse of the British Empire, you know that the 60s weren't so great either. And you know that in the mid-60s, a lot of countries were basically saying, I'm getting out, I'm getting out, I'm getting out. Tired of this, done with that. Yep, Kenya. Yeah, in the 1960s, a lot of various territories that had these quasi-protectorate relationships and imperial relationships with the British Empire decided to start bugging out. And in a way, it's like maybe the crack in the world was a psychological manifestation of the angst of an empire falling apart. I don't know. I really don't know. At one point, that British general stands up to, this is insane. It is insane, British general. Because if you give one geologist a nuclear weapon and they create a crack in the world, do you then give a second geologist another nuclear weapon to basically shove down a volcano? I have to say, no matter what happens next, this is the classic case of fool me once, geologist. I told you, said if I gave you a nuclear weapon, you promised you wouldn't break the planet. You know, you said you'd give us free energy for all time just by cracking a hole in the Earth's core. That ought to work out. And now, after creating a crack in the world in a sexy mid-60s British kind of way, now you want another atomic bomb, another hydrogen bomb, really, to shove down a volcano. And of course, we have to agree, because you're a scientist. I'm sorry, folks, but a crack in the world has to be one of the most implausible fucking sci-fi movies of all time. Not implausible in the technological sense. I have no doubt that if the governments of the world, that the crocodiles got together and decided they wanted to create a crack in the world, I have no doubt that they could do it. I'm 100% convinced of their ability to do that, but, you know, what's implausible is that they would give a geologist a nuclear weapon. Now, I know the government's stupid. Listen, folks. If you're going to tell me, is the government dumb enough to give a geologist a hydrogen bomb? I don't know. I really don't know. Part of me wonders if I shouldn't just say, soon we will find out. Because in the great discontinuity, strange shit happens. All kinds of bizarre, fucked up shit happens when history becomes undone. When the paradigms shift, the tectonic plates, they shift too. And yeah, it doesn't take a nuclear weapon, it just takes the vicissitudes of causality and human choice. I don't really know, folks. I don't know. But I know this. If I was ever in charge of the nuclear weapons, other than deciding to dismantle them all, the last thing on my list to do would be to give one to a geologist. And I know that sounds kind of, you know, maybe that's, is that prejudiced against geologists? Am I being prejudiced against geological researchers by thinking that they don't have a right to a hydrogen bomb? And in fairness, can I say this? Whereas, and let it be stated for the fucking metaphysical record of all infinite time and space, Sunday, it's just after 10 p.m. here in Little Saigon, and yeah, I can't really fully recommend A Crack in the World, but I do think it has a really cool trailer. And here's the thing about these old-timey trailers, if you've never noticed it, you really don't have to see the movie. The whole trailer basically gives away pretty much the whole fucking movie. Sure, 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 there are certain details missing, certain sexual liaisons in the caves of the earth with busty British blonde women who probably brushed their teeth. Although, probably all British people in the 60s had halitosis. I really don't know. But I don't care if you're a Republican, if you're a Democrat, or a Marxist, communist piece of shit. I don't care who you are. I don't care. You could be really cool like me and an anarchist. Or you could be some type of crevist. Or disestablishmentarian. Or maybe you are even a Discordian. Maybe we'll exclude the Discordians for this, from this example, but I think all non-Discordian political parties can agree. And even those of us who are anarchists can generally agree. Nobody should ever give a hydrogen bomb to a fucking geologist. But what's almost as bad is to assume that a nuclear physicist should work in the field of geology. Well, maybe, maybe not, but let me explain. Or rather, yeah, let me be fucking specific. If you've never heard of Operation Plowshares, I've mentioned it on my podcast before. It's kind of cool. A man by the name of Edward Teller, part of the original Manhattan Project to build the atom bomb during the Second World War. Edward Teller had a dream, you know. He wanted to capture a little slice of the sun. Thank you. Yeah, our good friend Edward Teller worked on the Manhattan Project during World War II. He, you know, worked under Oppenheimer with a whole bunch of other nuclear scientists and mathematicians and engineers. After the war, he continued in the nuclear program, and he was the chief scientist in the United States for the development of the hydrogen bomb. And the hydrogen bomb was like a scale above a normal fission device. In terms of performance, it was many orders of magnitude more powerful. There's almost no comparison. The weapons used on Nagasaki and Hiroshima were both under 30 kilotons. In fact, I don't think either got above 20 kilotons in yield. The initiator for hydrogen bomb, which is just a small fission device, is about 20 kilotons, maybe less. And that initiator is what superheats, I believe, the deuterium. I think it's tritium and deuterium, but I think mostly tritium. To temperatures so high that the tritium fuses and you get fusion. And from that, you get a very strong nuclear reaction, which creates a hydrogen explosion, a nuclear explosion, rather a fusion reaction explosion. And blah, 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 you have an incredibly explosive device. And Edward Teller wanted to use these fancy schmancy hydrogen bombs to remodel the world. He wanted to irrigate North Africa by creating giant canals and lakes by using nuclear weapons. So we can mock the geologist all we want to, but this actual stupid movie is really about Operation Plowshares, that kind of bullshit. Oh, we can just, you know, use a nuke to crack a hole in the world so we can fucking tap out some free fucking energy from the core. And this is the other thing too, folks. The assumption is none of this has any cost. It's all free. Now, I want you to meditate on this shit because it is a good example. Let's assume for the sake of argument that the energy inside the Earth is something we can tap into. Is it really free? Like, probably the first one of these super geothermal, let's shove a hydrogen bomb up the butt of the planet type plants, probably the first one, you know, doesn't do too much harm, probably. But the second one is going to start leaching more energy, and eventually, by the time you get to like about a million of these geothermal plants around the world that are all free energy, you're going to notice a couple things. Because the Earth is becoming, well, frankly, the heat of the Earth is bleeding out, right? The core will probably become less turbulent, which means it might even freeze up. And wouldn't that mean that the electromagnetic field would collapse? So I guess what I'm saying, folks, is that even if you could drill a hole into the core of the Earth, I'm not really sure that's free energy. I'm not really sure that's even energy we should extract. I'm fairly certain that energy is doing a job of allowing us to have a force field so we don't end up, you know, baking alive from particles from the sun and outer space. So I'm kind of convinced that the energy inside the Earth right now is doing a job. So let's go to another topic, shall we? Because I think we can all agree we're not going to give any fucking geologist a nuclear weapon. came to the realization today that, and this may already be a thing, like, I don't know, this is probably already the name of a porn star, but it occurred to me today that the perfect name for a porn star would be Busty Cavities. Busty Cavities. Busty Cavities is the perfect name of the up-and-coming porn star. Busty Cavities would probably debut sometime in the near future, maybe 2023. Probably in a Ron Jeremy flick before he dies. Is he dead yet? I don't know if Ron Jeremy is dead, but if Ron Jeremy were alive, he'd agree. Busty Cavities. Is that a fucking ambulance? Can you all hear that? Anyways. Yeah, I came to the realization today that if I was to invent a porn star, a female porn star from the ground up, I would need to find an ingenue. But the perfect name would be Busty Cavities. Especially if she was English. In the future, if there is a future, if there's a future where people imagine the impossible, in the future, if there is a future where people still want to race each other in fantastical vehicles of amazing technology, in the future, if there are still young men and women or other types of robots or sexual androids, in the future of high tech and rocketry and jet engines and plasma rifles, in the future of ion drives, in that future, people will want to race for speed. They won't give up on speed. They're not going to give up their cocaine. They're not going to give up their speed. So I'm about to describe a race in the year 2076. A race against time. Race against time, folks. In the future, young people will build rockets really powerful rockets that can go very, very fast. Some of them will be fueled by retired nuclear weapons. Some of them will be powered by other types of dangerous technologies. All of it, in the pursuit of speed. If you were to travel at 85% the speed of light for about one day, you would arrive 2 days later. If you were to travel at 85% the speed of light away from the Earth and then return in one day, it might just be one day for you. But it would be like 2 days later for everybody else, you fuck. It's a weird topic, but I was thinking about relativity today in the context of computation. Now, some of you may be saying to yourself, Dan, what does computation have to do with relativity? Imagine, for the sake of argument, that you had a relatively simple computer with an unlimited amount of storage space, which means imagine it had just a huge hard drive, huge amounts of memory, but was a relatively simple computer. But imagine you trapped it in a cave that essentially was stuck in a kind of time loop. Or rather, isolated from time itself. Which means that it could calculate for maybe 10,000 years, but not one moment passes. Imagine that you tethered that isolated space to a wormhole, and into that wormhole you could send instructions. You see, here's the thing, folks. Whether you're talking ordinary silicon-based computation, whether you're talking about biological computation, or even quantum computation, you're still talking about computation that takes place in the context of time. And in reality, if you could isolate a computer from time, just about any computer, in theory, could become a supercomputer. I want you to think back to something called the Turing test. If you don't know who Alan Turing was, Alan Turing was more or less one of the, how can I phrase this? Probably one of the most important mathematicians of the last 100 years, and in many ways, the founding father of computer science. You can't really think of computer science without thinking of Alan Turing, him, John von Neumann, a few others. He was involved during World War II. Alan Turing was involved in a project for the United Kingdom, for Great Britain, called Colossus. And Colossus was a codebreaker. And this codebreaker system was used against the German system called Enigma. Enigma used what's referred to as a multi-rotor cipher. And it was very complex, very difficult to crack, but not impossible. According to Alan Turing, anything we do as human beings, anything, everything we do as people, including our thinking, per se, can be reduced to an algorithm or to a set of instructions, or, if you like, a computer program. And listen, this has been a controversial subject for more than half a century now. There's a famous test called the Turing test. What is the Turing test? Well, frankly, now it looks kind of stupid. But the Turing test, imagine if all you could do was sit and chat with a keyboard and a screen, and you had to figure out if the person you're chatting with was a computer or a person, or if you found it indistinguishable. Like if you had a choice between A and B, and you couldn't distinguish between A and B, let's say A was the computer and B was the person. According to Alan Turing, if you were talking to A and talking to B, but you weren't really talking, you were just typing and texting, right? And you couldn't tell the difference. Then according to Alan Turing, for all intents and purposes, B is also, you know, an intelligent being, a conscious being. The Turing test is about whether or not a human being can distinguish between a human being and a machine. And in a way, it's a good test if you consider every dynamic. I think just typing text is probably not enough. There is a lot more that goes on with human communication than just, you know, words and letters and sentences. There's way more. That being said, folks, imagine for the sake of argument that you could reduce every advanced thing a human being does to a set of instructions. And also imagine for the sake of argument that you could do something probably even more impossible. You could isolate a computer from time, which means that you could put a computer into a kind of, well, its own little universe vis-a-vis time, where time does not elapse. If you could do that, and then you could somehow return a result, then in theory, just about any computer could become a supercomputer. Because again, from the perspective of the person asking questions, the computer is instantaneous. Every time you ask a question, it has an answer. Which is pretty freaky. And it gets worse from here, folks. Imagine you could isolate a computer from time, at least from any progression of time. But that same computer could observe the universe throughout all of time. Then all of a sudden, that computer could, well, it would literally see things before they happen. And its calculations get more interesting and spooky. I know this is a weird thought process, folks, but, you know, we live in strange times, and people want to convince me that technology will, can, must, should do everything, that there are no limits to the human being and what a human being can do, and soon we'll be traveling to the stars in hyperlight ships. Soon we'll be cracking holes in the universe with super colliders and whatnot. And that might be true. A huge portion of what we're talking about has to do with time. We measure complexity in terms of steps, for example. If you think of different ways of sorting items, like if you're going to sort a list of numbers or a list of words, some algorithms or programs for sorting that list are more efficient than others. For example, the bubble sort, which is the most naive sort, it's the kind of one, it's a sort that all that pretty much every computer programmer can just kind of write if they have an intuitive understanding of things, but it's also very inefficient. It has a performance of polynomial time, which is n squared, which means if you want to translate n to time, you could say t squared, okay? So if it takes 1 second to do an operation, it'll take t squared seconds to solve it using the bubble sort. But what if you could isolate that time from the system? Like, what if you could create a bubble whereby the computer could compute for a million years, but from your perspective, no time passes at all? All of this is impossible, of course. And yet, in this day and age, with the way in which we're sort of suckered into what I would call the cult of scientism, and I'm not opposed to science, folks, I'm not opposed to technology, but we're constantly told that there are no limits. Well, if there are no limits, then why not this? It is absurd. It is absurd because you could use a relatively basic computer to do this. And that computer would outperform a quantum computer because even the quantum computer operates in the context of time. But what's more important is that given any set of computers, quantum or otherwise, if you isolate them from time, it doesn't matter. If the algorithms are equivalent, the result should be the same. It is irrelevant whether it was a quantum computer, a Commodore 64, or some jackass with an abacus. It doesn't matter. As long as that jackass can live to be 10 million years old, it will get it done, and from the perspective of the observer, it all happened instantaneously. I know that's a weird conversation. But I don't know, folks. Next topic. I've spoken a little bit about the idea of simulation theory in recent weeks. And I don't want to go much deeper into simulation theory. If you're interested in it, I recommend you research it on your own. But I would like to talk about the concept of simulation. Or rather, the manufacturing of perception. Which is a little bit different, but also not. And I want to talk about this in the context of government, because one of the ideas that people will get sort of suckered into believing is that only in the 20th century did governments figure out that technology is helpful in manipulating people. That's not really true. I think governments have been in the business of manipulating people since their inception. It's just that in the 20th century, the technology improved a great deal. The tools got a lot better. I mean, think about movies and radio. Think about television. This is way before the internet, but think about the message you could broadcast with just movies, with just a fucking newsreel. Just the newsreel by itself before the movie played. That was powerful. I think governments succeed or fail based upon their ability to control your perception. If they can convince you that, you know, the reality you're seeing is either there or not there, they can succeed. And part of this is, I think, about education. You know, folks, a big part of perception is knowledge. I could move a spaceship across the sky if people were ignorant enough. I could have people walking gormlessly through the empty valleys of their own despair, surrounded by homeless people, and see nothing there, you know, if they were oblivious enough. And that's the thing, folks. If you can sort of remove the conception, if you remove the idea from their head and you block it, then they really never notice anything, do they? They don't see anything. They're in a simulation. And for a lot of young people these days, the lines between reality and experience have been quite, you know, I should say reality of the world or experience in the world, in the real world, and the computer world, it's become kind of blurry. A lot of folks, a lot of young people. In fact, it's gotten to the point now where every once in a while you'll see somebody walking down the street with goggles on. You'll say to yourself, what are you doing? What are you doing? What is the purpose of walking around the mall with these goggles on? You're seeing something special? You're participating in a magical fucking world? Is it better than the one you're in? A huge part of what government does is it tries to simulate the world. It tries to create an alternative universe that might be similar to the one around you, but it's not the same. And that universe usually aligns with an agenda. And that agenda may have to do with stealing people's resources. That agenda may be related to some sort of bullshit, I don't know, social justice cause. But that agenda is related to the simulation. And the simulation is designed for one purpose, and that is to direct you towards the goal. And the goal is obedience. I don't want to spend too much more time on that subject because the next one's going to be really weird. And in all likelihood, the next subject will be the last one for this podcast. It's going to be really weird. But yeah, I was thinking about that. You know, the whole idea that probably since the beginning of human history involving governments, governments have probably been in the business of creating artificial reality since the beginning. And again, back in the day, you know, what did you need to do? You hired a dude to go around town, screaming out your proclamations, telling people what the news was. You know, some dude would go around town telling you about the news. Sure, it might have all been bullshit, but how is that different than today? Next and last topic for this evening is a weird one. Maxwell, Clark Maxwell, famous scientist from the 19th century. I believe it's Clark Maxwell. Let me double check if I need to. Yep, James Clark Maxwell. James Clark Maxwell had a thought experiment that he proposed, I believe, in 1867. And the thought experiment was called, well, it's been referred to as Maxwell's demon. And Maxwell said, imagine you have two chambers. Chamber A and chamber B. In chamber A, you have a gas of a certain temperature and whatever. In chamber B, you have a different gas. And in between them, you have a demon, a little demon with doorway. And the demon with the doorway will open the door and allow high-speed or fast-moving molecules from chamber A to move into chamber B and allow only the slow-moving to go from chamber B into chamber A. So after some period of time, who knows how long, you have all of the really fast molecules in chamber, what? Chamber B? Anyways, you get my point. One chamber has all the high energy molecules, the other one doesn't. And this basically should violate, it does violate the laws of thermodynamics. Now, it's been criticized, blah, 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 over the years. And people say, well, you need to take the demon into consideration. All of this is true. All of this is true. Maxwell's demon is implausible. The idea that there could be this little demon that could, you know, make choices between high energy molecules and low energy or fast moving or slow moving. But what if, and this is a weird thought, but what if you could create a material or a field? And let's say it was a field, like some type of specialized magnetic field. And it's a permeable field, but only in one direction. And it is only permeable for photons. And if you don't know what a photon is a particle of light. I don't want to get into the wave-particle duality bullshit. That is a whole nother topic for somebody far better schooled in physics than me. But anyways, a photon is a particle of light. And let's say, imagine for a moment you could create an electromagnetic a space, a kind of cavity, maybe called a bottle or an encasement. But you could create a permeable encasement. And maybe it isn't electromagnetics. Maybe you're using crystal technology. I really don't know. Maybe you're using crystals. Maybe you're using some type of crystalline one-directional barrier. And then on the internal side, everything's reflective. So imagine you have this magical crystal bottle, a crystal bottle that allows photons to enter, but within the bottle, it is perfectly reflective. Over time, you would expect the photons to collect, right? And if you want to, you can call this photonic osmosis or something. It sounds ridiculous. Maybe it is a kind of thermodynamic osmosis, a lot like Maxwell's demon, and equally impossible. But if it were possible, then all of a sudden you have an interesting way, potentially, to take advantage of ambient energy in the environment. I mean, think about the whole conversation around zero-point energy. Zero-point energy is basically the contention that if you took any unit of space, any three-dimensional area, or I should say volume of space, okay, any volume of space, if you removed all energy from it, which means if you brought that space to zero Kelvin, which means no energy is supposed to be there. According to zero-point energy people, photons would simply emerge into that space. Photons always just spontaneously emerge, and who knows from where, right? Other dimensions, who the fuck knows? So even in that space of zero Kelvin, you would still have photons appearing. And that is referred to as zero-point energy. And if somehow you can tap into it, right, then all of a sudden you can have free energy, right? Maybe. I mean, think about that photon, too. Like this idea that photons emerge. Where do they emerge from? Well, maybe that's related to the same subject. I mean, again, if there was such a thing as a membrane that allowed the passage of a photon, would it be bidirectional? It might be. If it's bidirectional, then it would imply that would not be a capable, that would not allow you to create containment, okay? The photon would just keep going. You know, sort of like, well, I don't want to give a bad example, but it would just shoot across the screen, so to speak, kind of like playing Atari 2600 tank game, doing the bank shot across the screen back in 1982, if you know what I'm talking about. Anyways, yeah. I don't think that any of these ideas are interesting if we assume there are no limits. Like, even in this ridiculous thought experiment of our magical light bottle, and let's call it a light bottle or a photonic bottle, even our magical photonic bottle would have to have limits because you just couldn't allow it to accrue really pure energy. Because photons are, for all intents and purposes, a very distilled form of pure energy. So imagine you're just collecting photons from the environment. Eventually, that bottle must reach a point of capacity, and you're either going to release the energy, or it's going to explode. I truly don't know. When I was in high school, I had this weird idea about using mirrors to collect light energy. Like, why couldn't you do it? Why couldn't you use one-way mirrors and reflective surfaces to collect light, almost like you're collecting photons? I know, it was really stupid. I was in high school. But maybe, using magnetic fields, maybe you could do something like that. I really don't know. I don't know. It's a controversial subject. A lot of people think that our physics is inadequate, in part because we discount the electromagnetic aspect of these problems. And as a matter of, you know, historical record, there are examples of experiments using very strong magnetic fields that have impacted the behavior of light. There have been examples of these experiments. So it's hard to just sort of just, you know, poo-poo and say, well, technically, the thing is, technically the photon's not a charged particle. That's another thing you need to keep in mind. It has no charge. So no amount of EMF should impact a photon. And yet, there are examples, going back to the Philadelphia experiment, of the use of very strong magnetic fields to impact light. So, I don't know. It's a weird topic. Weird. Thermodynamic osmosis. Light bottles. Racing through space and time. To meet my future wife, Busty Cavities. Busty Cavities. Is she the woman waiting for you after you've won your space-time race? When you left for a day but arrived the day after tomorrow? Was she the woman waiting for you at the end of the ride? Busty Cavities. As if through some kind of space-time osmosis, your love affair drifted away. All of the computers are now destroyed. The universe is nothing but informational decay, but Busty Cavities. Busty Cavities. Busty Cavities. Busty Cavities. If you enjoy this podcast and you have taken care of all your food, water, and shelter, and you have all the resources you need to survive the coming tumult, if you have taken care of your dog, your cat, your mouse, your bird, if you've taken care of all the people you love, if you've already hired a hitman to take out all your enemies, and you enjoy my podcast, then by all means, donate. Currently, I have a Venmo link I shall include in this podcast. It's also on the homepage, my SoundCloud page, whatever. If you don't like Venmo, you can email me. There's an email link on the homepage, my SoundCloud bullshit. You can tell me you got Bitcoin, you got gold, you got silver, you got diamonds, you have French bulldogs in a warehouse. I will take your French bulldogs. I will sell them to Frenchmen. They will sell them to Serbians. You don't want to know what happens then, buddy. So for this Sunday, only a few minutes before midnight. For this Sunday, only a few minutes before midnight, I want you to go to sleep and dream good thoughts and dreams. Great one.